Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
Two freshman senators cross the finish line with some big legislation. Senator Liz Bolden talks about a new law to expand voting access, and Senator Nicole Mitchell highlights key investments to help veterans. Stay tuned for this and more on this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. A new law that proponents say will make voting more accessible in Minnesota has been signed into law.
It's more important than ever that we shore up this democracy. We shore it up for the people of Minnesota. We shore it up in this country. We show the rest of the world. The world's oldest and strongest democracy is strong. Minnesota is doing our part by making it stronger today. And this piece of legislation is just the exact type of things that Minnesotans asked us to do.
I'm proud to say that Minnesota's ballots will now be offered in additional languages. I'm proud to have fair and lawful campaigns. And I'm excited to see our young people engaged in the democratic process.
This bill is a historic victory, but it is not a partisan victory. Red states, blue states, and purple states have adopted the measures that we're talking about today. And that's because these reforms are nonpartisan in origin and nonpartisan in effect.
It is a generational moment where we have a choice to make. What we've seen over the last couple of years and the last couple of months is states across the country making a choice. We are making a choice for a thriving, multiracial, multigenerational, multiregional, gender-inclusive democracy.
As we are building the best state, that North Star state, in many spaces and in many ways, this is the work that comes before that. This is the necessary work that helps us to build that, to be sure that every voice can be heard, that we are making it easier for Minnesotans to vote, not harder.
Senator Liz Bolden is the Senate sponsor of the measure, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, congratulations on getting this bill across the finish line, and also welcome to the Senate. This is our first interview. Generally, what's important from your perspective for people to know about this new law?
So this is a package of provisions that really are geared to make voting easier, to put Minnesotans' voices at the center. We'll get into the details, but includes things like automatic voter registration, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, a number of things really aimed at Minnesotans and making voting easier for them.
So you mentioned automatic voter registration. According to the National Conference of State Legislatures, which known around here is the NCSL, 22 states and the District of Columbia have enacted automatic voter registration. So Minnesota is now the 23rd state to do this. Will automatic voter registration just happen at the Department of Motor Vehicles, or does it happen with interaction with multiple state agencies?
Yeah, it will start with just renewing driver's licenses, with the potential to expand to other agencies. And I'll just say, as you mentioned, you know, other states have been doing this, and red states, blue states, purple states. This isn't about this isn't a partisan provision. It really is nonpartisan, aimed at helping folks to vote. And it's called automatic voter registration, but they're really, it's sort of a misnomer, because behind this, it's seamless for voters. Behind the scenes, there's nothing really automatic about it. The same checks and balances go into place when folks interact with an agency and are providing the information necessary to know if they are eligible to vote. So, you know, proving that they are a citizen and that they are who they say they are and they live where they say they live and that they're over 18, they are placed, they're registered to vote. And so seamless for the voter, but still all the same processes behind the scenes. As I said, we'll start with driver's licenses, but has the potential as time moves on and systems are built and we need to get permission from the federal government, it may move on to other agencies as well.
And if there are individuals out there who do not wish to be registered to vote, do they have the option to opt out?
They do. So when that occurs, when folks have provided the information through interaction with the government agency and they are on the in the queue to be registered and those checks are happening, they will receive a postcard or a letter in the mail saying that you've been, you know, provided this information, you've been registered to vote. Let us know if you don't want to be registered. And they can mail that back and say, nope, don't want to be registered. It gives a window of 20 days for as a prompt to, you know, let us know. But if people go beyond that 20 days at any time, which is current now, at any time, if people are registered and wish to not be registered, they can request to not be registered, and that is honored.
Okay. More than a dozen states allow people to begin pre-registering to vote at the age of 16, according to a nonpartisan website that I found called Headcount. I have an almost 16-year-old at home. So what is your message to him and other 16 and 17-year-olds out there about why they should pre-register to vote?
I would say it's a great way to get involved and to start being engaged in the system because your voice matters. We have found through other states, as you mentioned, who have done this, when young folks get pre-registered, it really puts them on a path to being lifelong voters, which is what we want, right? We want everyone's voice to be included. And so this is a way to get them involved in the process and to make them feel like they are engaged and involved and able to be have that voice, which is exactly what we want.
And maybe start tracking the news.
Absolutely. They feel like they have a stake in what's happening.
No excuses, absentee voting was a big deal in 2014. Then voting by absentee ballot became crucial during the pandemic. Now, because of this law, Minnesotans will be able to opt in to a permanent absentee voter list. So who is most likely to benefit from this option?
Yeah, I will say this would be open to anyone who wishes to do so, and it really puts into place something which many Minnesotans thought was happening before. They had requested an absentee ballot and thought they got on a list, but previously, right now today, what happens is what they get is an application for a ballot, not an actual ballot. And so it was causing confusion with Minnesotans, honestly. So this streamlines that process for people who say, I want to vote absentee every time. They will get that ballot. And again, all of the same checks and balances occur in the background. But, you know, this especially impacts who we've heard from is folks with disabilities, folks who are older and have more mobility issues. It also could impact anyone because as anyone could take advantage of this. But it's
I love to go vote on voting day. It's just part of a thing that I love. But let's say I just don't want to be bothered, but I still want to vote. I could get on this list, and then the ballot would always come to me. And if I decided, no, I still want to go on voting on election day, I still could. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. The state demographer will now have a role going forward in determining the three most commonly spoken non-English languages in each census tract. So what information will now be provided to voter-eligible citizens for whom English is a second language?
So I'm really proud of this provision with the intention of getting information to folks in a language that is most comfortable for them. And this is something that Minnesota has a long tradition of. Going back for decades and decades, we have provided information in other languages. What those languages are has changed over time, and that's why it's geared at what are the top three languages. But it is meant for in those areas where there's a higher population of folks who speak, English is not their native language, they will be able to be provided written materials in their own language. And if there's an even higher percentage, there will be an interpreter available at polling places in those languages that are meaningful to them. Because again, we want people to have the information they need to be able to cast their vote and feel comfortable doing so.
And it's true that people can have functional English skills, but still when it comes to voting and understanding rules and complexities, your native tongue would be more beneficial.
Absolutely. When we're talking about sort of technical pieces or that conversational piece is different than sort of the details and mechanics of voting, which, again, we want to be sure people are clearly understanding and have all the information they need.
In a statement, you said that this bill will, quote, shine a light on secret spending in politics. People talk about dark money in politics. It appears that there is general suspicion among the public about where some negative ads originate, in election season. How does the new law increase transparency for voters?
This is one of the provisions that I have heard the most about from Minnesotans because that dark money spending is the most unpopular with Minnesotans. We should know who is spending money in our elections and who is trying to influence our vote. And so the provision in this bill limits that. It's two main things. One, and I won't get into the weeds of the wonkiness, but there's some rules about disclosure. It brings us up to the federal guidelines around disclosure of having to say who is spending this money so Minnesotans can know who's trying to influence my my vote. And the second piece is provisions around limiting the spending of foreign-influenced corporations in our elections. Because again, you know, Minnesotans don't want foreign voices, foreign influence in our elections. And so really limiting that. For corporations, it's not, this isn't about people, it's about corporations. And, you know, Citizens United has really caused issues and problems with that and limited what we are, you know, able to regulate. But we can regulate foreign influence corporations in our elections. And so that's the aim of this bill.
And one more question. Voter intimidation, harassment, and deceptive practices are spelled out in the law, and violators can be charged with a gross misdemeanor. What types of behavior is this law going to try to stop?
So again, we want Minnesotans to be safe and comfortable as they're casting their vote. And, you know, we're seeing a trend across the country of disinformation, misinformation, and people, often election workers, not feeling safe in doing the really important work to help, you know, to be sure that everybody can vote. And so this bill includes things like the disinformation piece of if there's an ad that says, oh, you know, be sure you vote on November 9th, but election day is November 8th, that's not okay. And so putting some regulations and limits into, you know, making sure that people can safely cast their vote.
Senator Liz Bolden, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
On a party line vote of 34 to 33, the Senate has passed a bill to create a state-managed paid family and medical leave program in Minnesota.
Expanding access to paid family leave benefits is the right thing to do. But this plan before us today is not the right way to go about it. I firmly believe a win-win is possible. Expanding access to paid family leave benefits in a way that fills in the gaps without this massive new bureaucracy, one-size-fits-all mandate, and additional tax on hardworking Minnesotans.
With each of my kids, I had to go back to work at around 3 weeks, still bleeding, still in stitches, still with lift restrictions, back working at Caribou, Macy's, early mornings, late nights. I couldn't do more than 3 weeks off because I couldn't afford to take any more time off. So tell me how any of the Republican solutions that I've heard today would have helped me or the businesses that I worked for. I still had to take time off. They still needed to fill my shift. And sure, they would have to pay 0.35% in a payroll tax, but I'm paying the other 0.35% out of my paycheck. And I also get to heal before I go to work.
Nearly $1,000 of current and potential wages will be taken from the median income family in this state. This is taking employees' money from them and bringing it into a huge government that will add an additional 400 employees. The only thing that benefits here in this bill, Mr. President, is the government.
You know, as physicians, we have an especially painful and direct view of the effects that the lack of this policy has on people's lives. As an obstetrician, I have watched helplessly as patients have been forced to return to work days after giving birth because they could not afford not to. It should be obvious to us that it's bad for new parents, babies, and families. You know, Senator Mann outlined the many benefits of paid leave in her opening remarks, but I think they bear repeating. Paid family leave leads to decreased maternal morbidity and mortality, which is important given the growing maternal mortality crisis in America. Paid family leave leads to better parental well-being and mental health, particularly important in light of our mental health crisis. Paid family leave leads to better health outcomes for kids, better employee retention, and decreased reliance on government services.
Senate Republicans agree employees should have an option for time off, to care for a sick child or dying parent, to have a baby or adopt a child, manage a military deployment, recover from surgery or debilitating accident, all without putting their family's stability at risk. We agree. The gaslighting we've heard today would tell you otherwise, but Minnesota Republicans agree we can offer paid family medical leave. We disagree on the approach. Despite the gaslighting, Mr. President, the Senate Republican plan provides paid family and medical leave benefits for employees without mandates or job-killing taxes.
How many times today did we hear the argument, businesses were going to shutter their doors, businesses were closed down, we can't have people walking off the job for 12 weeks? I mean, how dare you have a life outside of your employer? And we say these things as if leave doesn't already exist. This bill does not create a need for leave. It simply changes the way that we treat people when they take a very necessary leave from work.
Minnesota's significant budget surplus has allowed lawmakers to bolster support for veterans. Joining me to talk about the investments for veterans and military agencies and programs is the chief sponsor of the bill in the Senate and the vice chair of the State and Local Government and Veterans Committee, Senator Nicole Mitchell. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
This budget area received an additional $128 million from the budget surplus, the largest increase in Minnesota history. What message is the legislature sending to Minnesota's service members?
It's sending a very clear message that we care about our current military members, and we also care about taking care of you once you are retired and in a veteran status, that we want to take care of the whole person because it includes initiatives, mental health, homelessness, care of our veterans, things that will help current enlistees with fitness and also kind of that holistic person. So we just wanted to send a clear signal that everyone on board, because this has been a true bipartisan issue, loves that investment and cares about the people that have served our country.
New veterans homes in Bemidji, Montevideo, and Preston are scheduled to open this year. How will this, you know, current budget investment help both these new facilities and the facilities that currently already exist?
So we want to make sure everything's on track. So we have the funding for the new facilities. We have some language in there to make sure that the rates and everything are correct. We want to also be able to retain good staff with how we treat the people that are going to work at the homes. And in terms of the current facilities, also Hastings, for example, there's some money, not just in the veterans budget, but also some bonding money that we're going to upgrade some of the facilities and make sure that they continue into the future to be good places for our veterans to call home.
So just on the Hastings bit there, earlier in the legislative session, staff and residents spoke with the committee about some of the conditions at Hastings. What were some of their concerns? And you've sort of addressed how they're going to be aided with this budget, but can you just expand a little bit on that?
Sure. So some of the budgetary aid is just upgrading the facilities. For example, we have units where people have shared baths. And we want to make sure that, especially, you know, when we had dealt with COVID just a couple of years ago, sometimes having that sort of a shared facility isn't great when you're talking about health needs. So just making sure, and that was for some of our people that had addiction and different types of care. This wasn't the retirement homes. But just making sure that we're keeping our facilities as safe as possible and as upgraded as possible. So that's one thing budgetarily that we're doing. In terms of the staff, making sure that the leadership is the appropriate leadership going forward. We do have money for a facility survey in Hastings, and we also want to look at the facility in Minneapolis just to make sure that staff are being treated with equity, properly trained, things of that nature. We haven't seen a lot of problems where it's impacting patient care, so that's wonderful, but happy staff, well-trained staff will ensure that that also continues. So we want to make sure all of those issues are properly addressed.
There has been an ongoing effort to end homelessness among veterans. And I think I saw basically it's a net zero going forward with what this budget will put in place. Tackling the problem involves not just stable housing, but also mental health care, addiction care, and even job training. So how does this budget tackle those issues to really eliminate homelessness among veterans?
Yes. So as I said, we already have some of the domiciliary care, and that will help people. That's already ongoing, helping people with addiction and different issues where they have kind of a supervised space where they can work on those issues. We're also buying some facilities that will be new veteran housing so that there is a place for people to go and find that housing and find that community. We're doing, for the mental health side of it, a couple places where people can go for retreats and have that camaraderie. I have a provision that I carried in addition to the whole bill that is an expansion of Meals on Wheels for veterans that are not already served so that they will get home visits. We're trying to recruit veterans to be the people that also serve those wheels so they can have that contact, kind of a mental health check, and someone that can maybe direct them to other services if they're in need of that. So there's kind of a holistic approach to different types of things that can either keep veterans in their current housing or find them new stable housing, whether that's supported or not.
There's money for enlistment bonuses. As a current member of the National Guard, what is your pitch to people who are interested in military service? And are these enlistment bonuses enough to get recruitment levels up where they need to be?
So, you know, I got in originally because it was a way to pay for college, and I'm a third generation now military member, so I got the speech from my parents as well. But I clearly stayed in long after college. So not only do we have things like enlistment bonuses that help people with more money in their pocket, we have wonderful provisions for people to be able to go to school, have a lot of that paid for. We did increase some of our GI benefits, which also helps pay for school. The military medical is fabulous. So I know people that, for example, own their own small businesses and will stay in the military, both that sense of service, but also because then they have their medical needs met, very low cost. So there are a lot of things available for people that decide to join the military, and being able to expand the bonuses and some of the other programs like health and wellness. We have a big field house we're building that will be a new fitness center, programs like that. So kind of keeping people in and making them know that they're appreciated.
Full funding for a new facility for the Minnesota Military and Veterans Museum Camp, or I'm sorry, Veterans Museum at Camp Ripley has been achieved thanks to this bill. And I will confess that I did not know that this museum even existed until now. Generally speaking, why is it important that we have spaces that are dedicated to telling the stories of our service members?
So we have a current space at Camp Ripley, but it's harder to access and a lot of people don't know about it. So this will be a big new facility. And I think there's so many fabulous stories. They were just showing me a couple weeks ago of someone who ended up being a major head of government for the whole United States that had started here in Minnesota. And they were showing me that Purple Heart that the family had brought home for the museum. I believe there's going to be a section telling female veteran stories, some of our Hmong community and their involvement in Vietnam, for example. So I think having that sense of history is a really wonderful way to honor all the different contributions in the military, sometimes that people don't think about, and also for veterans to go and kind of see their stories and see a little bit of what they have brought to the table.
Last year, Minnesota veterans who served following the 9/11 attacks received service bonuses. Now the bonuses are going to be extended to include people who now reside in Minnesota but were not Minnesota residents when they entered the service. Why is it important to include them also in the bonuses?
Because they've just chosen to make Minnesota their home, and they served our country. So, of course, they should be included. We also expanded a couple of the conflicts that qualify for that, trying to include more people, because we want that sense of, we know you served your country. You know, I, for example, in my career have served in the Minnesota Guard, the Wisconsin Guard, and the Air Force Reserve for quite a while. And even though I happened to enter in Minnesota, if I had grown up somewhere else, I could have done a lot of my career in Minnesota, active duty, or somewhere else, and ended up in Minnesota. If you've decided to make Minnesota your home and you've served our country, we want to make sure that you've been honored in that way. So we've added a large chunk to the bonuses, and if that chunk runs out, we've committed to add more to that.
Senator Nicole Mitchell, thank you so much for your time today, and welcome to the Senate.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Lawmakers and advocates celebrated that Minnesota is one step closer to banning the non-essential use of forever chemicals from products sold in the state.
In January, we stood in this room together with a young woman whose body was being attacked by an insidious disease called fibrolamellar hepatocellular carcinoma. As you know, that young woman was my daughter, Amara Strandy. On that day, Amara gave reasons why the use of PFAS chemicals must be eliminated from the many products that needlessly contain them. Through her pain and exhaustion, Amara was willing to be a voice of those who have become the victims of illnesses that are linked to these forever chemicals. Amara called on the lawmakers of Minnesota to do what is right in passing laws that will not only protect our environment and human lives, but also force industries to find alternative ways of manufacturing their products without these deadly chemicals. As you may know, Amara died on April 14th, 2 days before her 21st birthday, and 3 days before the vote in the House. Amara wanted to do whatever she could, whatever strength she could call up, whatever needed to be said, to make her community a safe place to live.
We are going to introduce a resolution in the Minnesota Senate and the Minnesota House to honor the activism and dedication of Amara Strandy, who, as we have heard, spoke at each of these hearings on the PFAS issue, sharing the intimate details of her experience with PFAS and her cancer. And we will be enacting the laws this year, and they will be known as Amara's Law.
I am honored to join the fight begun by the Strandys to ensure that these forever chemicals are once and for all banned here in Minnesota. They originated here, and I believe we have a duty to lead the charge in their eradication from the environment, from our bodies, from our consumer products, from our water.
We are going to have a non-essential use ban of PFAS in Minnesota. We're going to give the MPCA the authority to determine what an essential use is of PFAS in a product across the state. But also, we are going to prohibit certain things from having PFAS for sale or distribution starting on January 1st, 2025. That includes carpet and rugs, cleaning products, cookware, cosmetics, dental floss, yes, dental floss, fabric treatments, juvenile products, menstruation products, textile furnishings, ski wax, and upholstered furniture.
This will be the strongest PFAS legislation in the nation. And that is significant because it was also unanimously agreed to in our conference committee by all House and Senate conferees, both Democrats and Republicans.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.